Hello and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. I have to say I've lost count of which episode this is, but it is 13th of June 2025. And this week we're supposed to be talking about SARS with Kate Kane and Nia Roberts from Woodgate and Clark. So, hi guys, how do you think the session went?
Good afternoon, Phil. Good afternoon. I thought in particular it was, again, a very good session, picking up off the back of a very, very popular first session that we did with Nia on employee and internal SARS. Obviously a very, very hot topic at the moment, hot topic in general, always in data protection. I thought the session was great. It was really, really good just to sort of fire out loads of questions. Loads of people having loads of different topics that they want to discuss. I'm glad that we could put it together and talk about it in particular with the changes. Very, very briefly about the Duo Bill, which will be a heavy focus of next week's session. But I do think it was a very, very interesting session. What do you reckon, Kate?
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. I was not surprised how much people engaged with us in the chat. It was crazy at that point. But it was really, really nice. To be honest, one of my favorite parts was when we touched again, and I think it's never enough, when we touched on the concept of business as usual information. I think is a very, very tricky area on SARS because, again, there are no formal legal definition on this. So it's kind of a gray area, a gray space for organizations, etc. Because in one hand, we have the BAUs that can include emails, can include messages that are just routine and part of operational data, part of the data of the organization. But on the other hand, we have small fragments that can contain personal data. So they kind of technically came may or may not within the scope of the SAR. So I think it was a very, very good session. And I like this topic. What about yourself, Nia, Phil?
I think it was fantastic. It was really, really interesting, especially around discussing kind of what classes as management forecasting as well. Kane and Kate, you both kind of touched on that. But also the really good question about appraisals and is that considered, personal data? And then if a third party is mentioned in there, can that be used as management forecasting? So it was a really good session. As you both said, the chat was going crazy with questions, which was really, really great to get so much engagement.
It was going bananas, wasn't it? I spent most of the time reading the chat and writing stuff down that we needed to go back and address. But what's really nice is that everybody else is commenting, we're just leading the session. Everybody else on the session, the privacy practitioners, are equally as qualified as we are to talk about these things. So they're all kind of commenting and helping each other. And that's really nice to see because somebody's saying, can I take this approach? And people say, well, I do, and I've never had a problem. Mm-hmm. No, I do, and I've never had a problem. Well, that's reassuring, isn't it? Because it can be a lonely role as a DPO.
Yes. Yes.
No, I think we're fostering a real, well, we have fostered for a long time a real community in the space for practitioners to come together and share their ideas, which is super refreshing.
That's our aim.
Great.
That's our aim. Well, if there's nothing else to say, then we'll leave you to it to tuck in and enjoy the session. There's been nothing in the news, and then suddenly,
not quite.
whoosh, you get the Duo Bill going through.
Finally, it's been quite of a journey, I would say.
I wasn't expecting it, to be honest. I was a bit shocked. I was expecting a little bit more of parliamentary ping pong, to be honest. So I was caught very much unawares when Miles had pretty much come running through to the office declaring it to everybody.
So that's going to be really interesting, isn't it? Because one of the things, when we were on the pre-session earlier, I said, I'm going to suggest there's not a lot to it, really. But actually, one of the big things is reforming the ICO. I mean, how is that going to work? What's that going to mean in terms of continuity? That'll be interesting to see. And of course, one of the big things, which is absolutely right, is reclassifying the PECA consent. Again, I think that's something that has been long overdue. So that is a welcome move. So we're going to do a session on that, aren't we, in the next couple of weeks, a big long podcast session. We're going to release some information to help people who aren't fully aware of it, sort of shortcut all the reading and get their heads around the double. Anyway, is there anything else you've seen in the news this week?
Well, I'd like to probably mention something similar to the news, but a little bit separate, probably about what happened at DPP last week, in terms of we hosted our very, very first in-person event, didn't we, on the topic of SARS.
Yeah.
Obviously, very topically, specifically for the housing sector and disrepair claims. And for a first time go around, I thought it was fantastic. Obviously, me, Kate, and Phil were there doing our thing. It was really, really, really interesting to hear from loads of other people as well and get some experience from other really well-experienced DPOs. You know, hopefully if there's any people in the chat that were there last week on the Thursday, I believe it was, you know, I hope you guys had a really good time. We've got some really positive feedback, so we're hoping to carry that forward going forward and hopefully doing more. So just to more tell you to watch this space, because I do think there'll be lots more coming, and you know we definitely really enjoyed them. I know Phil loved it.
Well, what was good? Yeah. What was the best thing for me was getting 20 or so privileged practitioners, including myself, Nia. Yeah. You know, we were people, privileged practitioners around the table talking about SARS. You know, in quite some detail, and we had lots of different levels of experience. People who only just moved into the role, you know, and then people who've been, you know, extremely competent, capable, really good, you know, sound data protection practitioners and you know, good with their law, and such a range of different approaches, interpretations. And that was what was most interesting to me. People saying, oh, I use this exemption in this way, and people, you know, so some of those things that came out, I think we're going to touch on today. But it was just great to kind of facilitate that coming together of people. I think, and people travelled from all over the place, didn't they, to come to Leeds.
They really came from all over the place in the UK. I think it was great finally to put some faces into the names, because obviously we are here in this side exchanging emails and see the cases, but was one of the first time that we have like actually a face-to-face, but therefore to carry on. But you are 100% right, Phil. I think the most exciting thing was to discuss something that was actually applicable to all the organizations that were with us, but to see how different type of management that the different organizations had was brilliant. And the fact that we just provided that, just provoking like a provoking subject or something, and everyone just round table discussing what will be the best approach, being a small or different organizations. One of the things that we were in our session, Kane, was I'm not sure if you remember, was the fact that when we are talking about SARS and disrepair, was the lucky people that had actually the data protection and officer and the team around data protection, and then actually a legal team separately, and then actually the small organizations that only have all together. So it's actually very interesting to see the differences between having a separate department or not. But
100%,
I really enjoy that.
Now, I noticed, moving back to news very briefly, I noticed that a shopper has been put on a facial ID watch list by Home Bargains for allegedly stealing a 39p packet of paracetamol, which she claimed she didn't steal, they were hers anyway, that they confiscated off her. I mean, it's quite tricky these days when you default you don't get a receipt, isn't it? But she's challenging. She's gone to the ICM challenging. I mean, it's interesting to see, because there's all sorts of stuff in the press about Asda and Tesco being challenged on facial recognition software. And I'm doing some work for a client looking at biometrics. They're using fingerprinting for access control. I've reminded them about Serco, but the supplier is saying that despite calling it biometric data, the algorithmic impression of a fingerprint, they say, doesn't classify as a fingerprint, which is an interesting take to me. So I'm just wondering whether they've got some strong hashing technology, which means that the fingerprint is digitized and then hashed and irreversibly, but you could tell if the same fingerprint matches it. So I'm really keen to get under the skin of the technology to find out how it works. But I don't know if you saw that in the news about Home Bargains.
That is pretty interesting, isn't it? In relation that obviously it was used to potentially identify someone who, in her mind, hasn't done anything wrong. But I mean, that can be the difficulty, I suppose, in the sense that the accuracy of being able to collect what has or hasn't happened, you know, the truth of the fact is, you know, she may well have stolen, she may have not done. I suppose that can be the complication. Yeah, is the
complication or the challenge is it in the substantially in the public interest?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the case.
To bar somebody for a 39p alleged offence that actually they didn't prosecute.
I mean, I think the will likely fall short of justifying substantial public interest for the biometric surveillance and profile, because I mean, it was the fact that they were using the substantial public interest as a lawful basis, and then the fact that she was blacklisted, and when she tried to return, she could not go to the wagons because of the 39p paracetamol. And I feel cases like this and the ASDAs and Tesco's, etc., just put our biometric blacklisting creates just a clear risk of data-driven exclusion of people. It's just very risky.
It's quite extreme,
isn't
it?
Yeah,
I think there needs to be more proportionate look on things like that. Definitely when you're excluding someone, you know, from stores, it needs to be proportionate. And I don't think 39p is proportionate, especially when it could have been, you know, as she said, an error.
Yeah, is it a lifetime ban, though? I mean, surely there must be some time. But I mean, I read somewhere that Tesco are doing replays of you packing your bag. They call it the VAR of shopping. So they do a replay. Are you sure you put everything in your bag? Here's a replay.
VAR of shopping. Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah,
it's like, if it's anything like football VAR,
I can't imagine it'll be very good.
Anyway, is there anything else to talk about in the news, or shall we move on to subject access requests? Favorite topic.
I saw just one news about the European Commission wants to facilitate the record of processing activities requirements. So kind of like
they're reforming it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Kind of mirroring what happened or was about to happen with the DPVI bill, was actually changing and facilitating and reforming the ROPA requirements and making it more kind of simple in order to relieve kind of the burden for organizations that, and I believe the number is 750 employees. So
yes, under that, the proposal is if you're under 750 employees, you won't need to keep a ROPA unless you've got high risk processing activities. So all you're doing really is shifting the burden of, you know, into testing your processing activities.
Yeah.
You know, is this high risk likely to result in a high risk? Well, you know,
Do you think you need to market it to a threshold, though? Does it really need to be a threshold? I mean, I understand to an extent, you know, if you're like a sole trader and you start cracking on and you do the plumbing or something, I would understand that to an extent. But businesses of most sizes, even small, of
It could be 10, like Cambridge members. Analytica. Kate, how many employees did Cambridge Analytica have? They were relatively small, weren't they?
But it could be processing masses of data.
I think the fact that just using a number to determine if you should maintain a ROPA is actually itself a risk. I mean, how many companies, as you mentioned, like have like 20, 30 employees, but they process special calculator in high volumes and high risk activities every single time. And I feel it's very, very risky to try. I do understand, to be honest, I do understand in a point that you want to relieve kind of burden of small organizations that probably don't have the same budgets or the same type of money that's bigger organizations. But is it a ROPA the right place to go and try to relieve that pain? I don't think it is, because I understand that the ROPA is just not just a ticking box exercise. It's way more than that. It's something that we will understand the life of a company, services, accountability, internally and externally. So I think it's the wrong move.
Yeah. So last thing on the news, I suppose. Well, I think last thing on the news is that, of course, this DUA bill might threaten, or there's talk it might threaten the UK's adequacy.
Yes.
But the other thing that I've read about on adequacy is the changes that Donald Trump is making in America is potentially going to threaten the relationship between the EU and the US, which in turn will affect us because we're piggybacking on the European data protection framework. So again, as ever in the world of data protection, very fluid, dynamic situation, which is why we like working on it. Yeah, Carl's going to get rid of some people. Andy's going to hide the fact he's planning to get rid of them under the planning and management forecasting exemption, if anybody was to make a SAR about it. Now, Shirley's raised an excellent point to help us move into talking about subject action quest. Now, we can either come back to that if you want to think about it, or we can sort of dive straight in and have a look at it. Because one of the things we talked a lot about during the session last week was about the exemptions, didn't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And we talked about, you know, people, again, this is probably, you know, maybe is news to some, but we did talk about using, for instance, the abusive process as manifestly unfounded and excessive. And there was quite a lot of people saying that they have used this as a matter of course. You know, any SAR coming in a social housing environment, which is related to a claim of disrepair of a property, they're just automatically bouncing it back saying, nah, abusive process. And so far, none of those people who are using that technique have actually been challenged by the data subjects, their legal representatives, which is interesting, or by the ICO. So that was quite interesting to think about.
Yeah, I think that was like one of the biggest takeaways for me for the event is because I have a couple of customers who do say that they roll it out, and I thought it was just, you know, one or two within the space, but it does seem pretty wide cast that these are being refused, but there's a lot of people that also aren't refusing them. You know, there's a lot of customers that are seeing them as a big issue, and, you know, it's not necessarily our position to weigh one side or another. But I do think it was a huge takeaway. Obviously, the fact that it's already part of the pre-action protocols, the data that they're bound to receive at some point or another. And I do think it is a very interesting development. Something that, it's hard for us to comment on, I think, but I do understand, like, also the grounds for it to an extent.
Yeah, now, I mean, I think it might have been the Freevacy newsletter that came in today, or might have been, I think it was a Freevacy newsletter that was referring to a case in Holland, which I actually read this morning. I saw it outside of the Freevacy newsletter. Similar thing. So a SAR went through the courts, and the courts ruled that if it was subject to a different civil process procedure, that there was rules around it not having to, the organisation not having to comply with the SAR. So that was the kind of, again, interesting that, you know, it's not just our colleagues are taking that view, but actually in that case, you know, the court in Holland, admittedly, you know, and I think it was a lower court, but it was, again, taking the same kind of a view.
Mm-hmm.
But it all likely to change because we'll have vexatious, which will come through in the DOA Act as well, won't it? Now, what did you? I mean, what did you particularly? Anything you particularly wanted to raise? Talk to Nia. Anything you particularly wanted to raise today, Nia? I mean, we talked a lot about last time. You were instrumental in the conversation, and we so far have allowed you to get a word in edgeways. So, is there anything that carrying on from the last session that you wanted to pick up on, or anything specific to raise?
Yeah, I think it was really interesting. I've been doing a lot of thinking, obviously, following on from the last session and conversations internally and things. And I think, you know, we had a really, really big discussion internally about business as usual data, which I know Phil absolutely hate. But we were discussing kind of what constitutes, when an employee makes a subject access request, what constitutes that business as usual data. So we had some really, really good discussions around that internally. And we can really see the difference of opinion. What someone's business as usual data for one person may be business as usual and not business as usual data for another. So it's really quite interesting, especially when you think around kind of when there's been management restructures or when there's been potentially, you know, redundancies, things like that. Do those documents and does the information around business as usual data, would that fall under that? And as such, do we need to kind of either heavily, heavily redact a lot of the information or not provide it at all because it is business as usual? So, we had some very, very interesting conversations around that.
Yeah, I don't even know what the phrase means, business as usual data. You know, is this business data that's not personal data, or is this personal data that would normally, like a bank statement, would normally be requested through a different process, not a SAR? So I don't like the phrase. I don't really understand what it means, and I think therefore it can be misinterpreted.
No, I've had a similar issue. I've always treated it as like strictly business information in terms of business, the information that only relates to the business. But I also see it being used like really broadly. like just to cover like sort of.
But why don't we call that everything. Not personal data? Why are we calling it business as usual data?
No, it's a not fair personal point.
Data. You're not entitled to
fair
it.
Point.
Because in the end of the day, even if he's considering, it's true that he's the intention behind it is trying to often use an internally by organization to describe kind of what routine communications, operational data that is generated by everyday work and everyday kind of daily basis work-wise. So it's directly associated with it. But in the end of the day, if you go deeper than that, is actually kind of personal data in a sense as well, because people are actually involved in these internal communications, and it's true that they are associated with work email addresses and names associated as an employee, but they actually are identified through this communication. So I would challenge in saying that probably is personal data as well. It can be personal data, but is I think the intention is actually the thing that is directly related to routine communications and operational data related to the business. So I'm not, I think I would more go more for that. I think it's kind of tricky, to be honest.
Really, it is tricky.
It's very tricky.
I think understanding where the subject, why they've made the subject access request can really help narrow down that you know, non-personal data, that actual business as usual data.
Yeah.
So understanding where the individual is coming from, if there has been an issue or an incident, or they've specified something within their subject access request that's why they're making the request. Yeah. I think is really quite important to be able to narrow it down and go, well, this is what you're actually looking for, so you don't need all that information.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the why is crucial a lot of the times, even if the why isn't coming behind the data that they're requesting specifically, but the purpose behind why they're asking for the SAR in the first place. I think that it is absolutely crucial. It's one of the things that I think we discovered quite a lot, Kate, in our discussion in the in-person event, is seeing some people taking the approach of almost stripping back a SAR, looking at its sole intention. Like, why would an individual feel the need to make a SAR in this instance? Is it because they feel like they've been treated unfairly? Is there an element of distrust? Do they just want to understand or want like further communication on a process that they're not sure what's going on because it's away from their eyes? You know, I think there is, of course, SARs can be used in an attempt for phishing, and it is often sometimes the case, but I think getting behind the why of an individual actually feels like they need to make one is really important. And we had a guest who spoke up at the in-person event who's talking about how he links SARs back to specific events. So for like repairs or with grievances, he's tying them to events and why they might have occurred. So maybe a lack of communication within the repairs process. So the individual wants to know what's actually happening, why their tap hasn't been fixed, or in the instance of a grievance, you know, have we communicated properly why we're taking the actions that we've done? Do we feel like we've been as transparent as we can do with this individual?
Yeah.
And I think that is really important as well. And of course, that's not going to stop these SARs, but being able to identify where, you know, the patterns of why these SARs are made could help potentially reduce the volume or the impact of the SARs that you are receiving.
100%. I think it's a very, very good point, because we came to the conclusion with the round table that majority of the SARs, part of the SARs, 50-50, were actually because the poor process and insufficient processes from other departments, so from the repair departments, complaints, customer service, etc. So actually the SARs were happening because these departments themselves were actually not responding as they should, or at least in a level of respondents was not very, very accurate. And so there was increasing of SARs. And the same with actually, we came across the data breaches as well. That is another conversation for another day.
But
I think that is actually a very tricky area, particularly because we don't have actually a definition about what actually could consider one or the other. One thing that I normally, and we discussed this in the last session, is if we can include this as in our procedure, what actually the organization understands as a business as usual information, and what actually is the lines that organization is specific, see or not see as business as usual, I think is a very, very good guidance for the people that are managing the SARs. I think could be a good one to include.
Now, Sarah's question, if we got to scroll back up to the chat, 12:51, I wanted to come to that because I thought we'd had a discussion last week about volume. And I'm sure that one of the people there who's extremely, you know, well-versed in this and extremely confident in their working with the data protection law said that they do take that approach. If it looks like it's too big, they say, no, you have to narrow it down for me because I'm on my own here. So I think, and again, I think that person might be on the session. So if I have not misinterpreted what was said, then it might be that that's what was said. But I think, you know, you got good grounds. I mean, the thing is about working with the data protection laws, we keep saying it is vague. It is woolly. It is quite ambiguous in parts. And you don't necessarily know you got it right. You know something's not right, but you don't necessarily know what is exactly right. So you do what you can. You do your best. You document your position. You build yourself a defence if you get challenged. And you go with it. So if you were to say, look, you know, I can't deal with this because I'm on my own and it's a year's worth of stuff. Now, the ICA will either say, well, that's your problem for having too much data. You need to get your attention under control because that's what their guidance says. Or they might take the view. They say, no, that's quite right. You know, that's not, you know, that's right. You know, you got to narrow it down. So you never know which way they're going to jump. So you kind of do what you think is right, I think. And then what's the worst that can happen? The worst that can happen is you get challenged. You know, and you get told, no, you got that one wrong. But what you don't get is put in prison. What you don't get in anybody's experience is fined. What you don't get is a black mark put against you. So, you know, we're there left working with this community to try and figure out what's the best approach. But I've seen that done, Sarah. I've seen people say, no, we haven't got the resources to deal with this. It's such a broad, wide thing. What actually do you want? Now, if they come back and say, well, I just want to make sure what you're processing is right and, you know, exactly what, sort of reeling back to the recitals of the GDPR, then I'm not sure again where you stand there. But we've also done SARS where it's taken us absolutely months to get through, months and months. We had a team of 10 people working on one SAR, which was actually three people's data. I would have thought for 25, 30 weeks. Well, again, in our experience, as long as you communicate with the data subject,
I agree.
We haven't seen anybody get battered over the head by the ISO saying, you know, you've overshot your statutory fit time frame.
I think one of the messages that me and Ken tried to pass over within our sessions were the most important things when we are dealing with SARS, aside from anything else, is the communication and transparency with the data subject. Because I feel like we have the law and we have obviously all these guidance and instructions and guidance from the ICO and the legislation that we need to follow. But at the end of the day, the data subject is exercising their rights. On the other hand, we have the interests of the organization and we need just to balance both of them and try. If obviously nowadays we are in the summer and probably will be people on holiday, and probably in terms of SARS, if there are some SARS coming in and probably there will be no people to actually carrying out those SARS, etc. I mean, transparency and communication is actually the key. It's true, for example, that ICO guidance on that is clear that you cannot just refuse a request just because involve a large amount of data. So, and obviously that will identify internal problem, probably poor retention periods, or actually don't have a good procedure in terms of SARS, or is not very clear. But if you pass over that concerns and try to justify yourself and try to appeal for understanding of the data subject, I think in the end of the day, what they will do to you is just challenge yourself. More than that, you did everything you could. And you are not just saying, you are not refusing anything. You are just asking probably more time. And
So what the GDPR doesn't say, you know, you can refuse on that basis. You have to demonstrate why it's excessive. But you just have to put an argument together and you know, see whether you can narrow down the scope. I was trying to find them. Whilst you were all talking, I'm trying to find this thing I read about the Dutch. I still can't find it now. It's like...
I was
finding
myself, what are you doing?
It
just looks so
focused. Mine's covered quite an interesting point just at the bottom of the chat there. About an ex-employee requesting all phone calls, chats and video calls that were included uh, based basically, presumably with their time as an employee, which would include internal conversations with management and colleagues, of course, and as well as external with your customers. Would these fall within the scope of a SAR, or if you exempt certain calls, would you include generic call recordings? And I think that's a really interesting question, because it kind of leads me back onto the conversation we was having in terms of like business as usual. And in terms of if that sort of stuff would fit within the scope. I mean, first and foremost, if they have been an ex-employee and they want all these conversations, is that reasonable? Is that even probable? Like, could you actually do that realistically? I think I suppose it depends on the nature of their role, doesn't it? But I imagine if someone like me or you made a SAR like that, Kate, whose whole life is meetings, yes, basically, and talking with people on Teams, is that something that's even feasible in terms of being able to recall all of those, disclose all of those first and foremost as well? Because as they say, there's conversations with management of a colleague, obviously that's their data as well. It's going to be fairly certain who those individuals are, of course, because it's conversations that he's had. And I do wonder what kind of approach you take to requests of that sort of vein.
I mean, in here, I think in the end of the day, calls and transcriptions and messages, etc. And that's the risk, isn't it, about using all these platforms that you use as Teams and WhatsApp and etc. is a risk of actually having personal data of data subjects. And in the case of the SAR, we actually need, in principle, to recall everything altogether. Actually, I was reading some ICO guidance before preparing myself, and it was about a very interesting point about the social media. If the companies actually have social media, such as LinkedIn, Facebook groups, etc., if they will be included or not, because obviously it's data of the company and employees involved. But in terms of approach, I would say that there will be some data that will be considered in principle like under the scope of the Article 15, so it will be personal data. Then try to understand the scope. Is it business as usual or not? Or is actually identifying the individual and just their personal information about themselves as a data subject? And surely in here will be exemptions that will be applicable, in particular probably management planning, or a legal privilege, or even third-party exemption. So I think probably the management forecasting exemption will be the one, if there were actually, we come to the conclusion that Article 15 will be applicable, probably exemptions like this will be as well.
And one of the things I was just trying to write, there's such a lot in the chat, I've written down the full of questions that we need to come back to, so everything's all moving too fast. But the exemptions are interesting, because we talked about them last week, and somebody was suggesting using the self-incrimination exemption for, again, withholding information relating to disrepair claims. I wasn't sure about that, because of the way the self-incrimination exemption is worded. It talks about people or person, and it talks about, you know, if it would make them liable to proceedings for an offence, you know. So I don't think that. My thoughts were, you know, you need to have a more detailed conversation as to which particular offence might you be committing, and therefore be liable to proceedings for that offence, and whether a corporate body would be able to use it as a defence, because it's a legal person, but it's not actually a person. You know, what's the intention of the Data Protection Act, that exemption? Is it to protect individuals, or is it to protect corporations? So that was an interesting, because I'd never thought about. I'd actually never really looked at the self-incrimination exemption in any detail before. But quite a few months ago on this podcast, we did have a brief conversation about the elasticity of things like management forecasting and planning. What does it relate to? What sort of planning activities? And everyone uses examples about redundancies and things. But what about other activities? You know, how could we apply it, or could we apply it to other, you know, business activities? You know, Could you, on disrepair claims again, could you bat back a SAR saying, I'm sorry, but we're still planning our approach to this repair scenario. Therefore, we're thinking this might prejudice our position. Therefore, we're applying this exemption. How far can you take it?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, if someone came to me with a disrepair one, I'm not sure if I feel like it would have that much weight. But maybe it's just because I see it too literally in the sense of.
I'll have to write a better argument then, but I bet I should.
sorry, Phil. In terms of, because obviously it's very easy to think of it in terms of redundancy, but I do think there are also other elements that can factor into it. Obviously, investigations on employees in particular, even if it's just in relation to potential misconduct or maybe just investigating based on grievances and stuff along those lines. If it is disclosing how they're going to undertake those investigations, maybe, or who they may need to
if a disclosure is going to prejudice the conduct of that business activity, that's the acid test. Now, if you can demonstrate it can, admittedly for a period of time, because over the course of time, all this thing was planned, but it either did or didn't happen. But I just wonder whether it gives you some relief and some protection, at a point in time. How elastic is it?
It does make it sound quite broad, though, doesn't it? I think if it's anything that could impact a business decision, that could be loads of things. Could be in relation to, obviously, people getting promoted, people getting fired, like change, obviously, structuring the business,
redundancy, of course,
but larger changes in the business as well, separate from those. It could probably cover quite a lot. I think depending on how you choose to interpret the wording, because of course it is very vague, which gives you the element to justify.
Yeah,
which
gives us a scope, doesn't it? Yeah. People have forgive me for diving about on that, but I mean, so do dive in and drive this in the direction you want to go in. But I want to go back to calls, because there's a few people talk about calls here. Now, we often take the view that if the data subject's been party to that information in the first place, i.e. they've had that email before, why would you not release it to them again? If they were on a call, why would you not release the call recording to them despite it concerning other people? Because they knew those other people were on it in the first place.
Yeah.
So it's not really...
Yeah, is there a risk there? It is a good point. And I've had that with like call transcripts, because you get a lot of transcripts coming through, don't you, within SARS. And it's just like, do we have to redact the third party data? Should we disclose it? Should we not disclose it at all? But it is a conversation that they have had. It's a conversation that they've had. Everything's been given to them in that instance. Is there inherently a risk?
Is it reasonable in the circumstances to disclose the third party information? In that, my view, it is, because the callers knew who was on the call. They knew what was discussed. That's the tack I would take. But I mean, again, if you're listening to like a big tape, like, so you won't remember this. You're far too young. Let's say you're a tape recorder recording all your calls. Isolating the calls might be a real problem. But these days with MP3s and things like that, it's probably really, really easy to isolate those calls and say, right, that one, and that one.
But what about if, do you think there's instances where it isn't reasonable? Like, what if you've just caught an employee on a bad day and, they're quite upset, or they get quite angry, or they lash out? Would it be reasonable to then disclose that of them having maybe a bit of a paddy? Would that maybe?
No, I don't know. I'd have to think about that one. But where it wouldn't be reasonable is if I was having a conversation with you about Kate and it was recorded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
So, but if all the parties were on the call, then again, it happened. It's fact, isn't it? The fact we've recorded it. Why would the data subject not be entitled to a copy of that?
Yeah. No. It's a good point. I think James kind of mentioned on the point of using them for training purposes, and obviously that usually leads to recording them organization wide. But a good sort of rebuttal is just get rid of them as quickly as you need them. You need a handful of them for training purposes, if any. And if you review it often enough, then you're not going to come across this issue as often, hopefully.
This is about me having calls. I think Kate's, particularly good on the phone. So I use Kate's call recordings in my training sessions.
Yeah.
And I think that Kate's particularly bad on the phone. So I have his call recordings to demonstrate how not to do it, for instance. That's,
but I mean, show how rubbish I am.
You're right, though, Kate.
It's a warning.
Yeah, you're right. I think you're right, Kate. You need to be doing this constantly. Yeah. Maybe only to pick up on the poor calls, of people who you might think on. And it's the same with CCTV. We're doing CCTV for security purposes. So presumably when you get to work and you haven't been broken into, you think, well, we don't need that anymore. Just get rid of it. Mm-hmm. No, we keep it for 30 days. Why do we keep it for 30 days?
Mm-hmm.
But it does require like a heavy sort of eagle eye over everything, doesn't it? And I think that's probably the issue. Is that if I have to go and look at the CCTV every day and go, oh, okay, well, we've not been robbed, I'll delete that. And you got to do that every day and every day and every day and watch all the maybe that's where it becomes more of an issue. Yeah. Probably not the time taken, if anything.
Yeah.
George's point is absolutely spot on, isn't it? What about AI on voice recordings and deep fake and things of that nature? That's a really good observation of the modern world we live in.
Yeah, no, that is it's a tad scary, isn't it? What can be done in terms of the the deepfakes and the recordings.
If we're happy to release, let's say we are, just for the sake of argument, to release core recordings, what about the, going back to Shirley's comment earlier about biometrics, why would you not release biometric data to a data subject? I mean, obviously, you may have to redouble your efforts on ID verification to make sure you weren't disclosing biometric data to the wrong person. That could be catastrophic, couldn't it?
Interesting point.
I'll let you think on that.
Yeah, I've been thinking on the biometric point since you brought it up, Phil. I've been racking my brain silently.
I mean, what exemption would you possibly be able to rely on? You know,
I don't see one. Yeah,
I think if you're going to the extent of recording that information about people, then surely they're entitled to a copy under
the silent. I think my response is that they disclose it. I think the fact that I can't come up with anything probably means that they would probably disclose it. I don't understand. I don't see why they shouldn't.
Well, it's hard to get. Maybe, it's really hard to get out of the system. Maybe.
Yeah. Is that enough of a reason?
It'd be really interesting to speak to someone who's a data protection officer for one of these big Tesco, Asda, just to see if they do disclose it and what exemption they use if they don't.
Has anyone from Asda or Tesco listening?
Yeah, have a chat with Joe. Joe knows people that are big multiple retailers. Other brands do exist. And the same with appraisal. Gareth, Tony was talking about appraisal applications right the way back at 12:55. I've got a note of that as well. So, again, what would be your reason for not disclosing? You have a meeting with somebody, you talk about their performance, you write up notes from that. I would have thought it was a matter of course to disclose that for them to sign it to say that's a true reflection of the discussion in case you need to lie on it to get rid of them.
Yeah, no, typically. Well, typically, I would say that is the case, isn't it? First and foremost, it's within the scope of what a SAR is. It's the personal data. Secondly, I think for the process of an appraisal, they're probably likely to see it to see the content that's been put up there to ensure that they're happy and that they agree with whatever's discussed. But it does lead on to that interesting point with how far you can stretch the management.
When he mentioned it,
I was thinking about it.
I think if is appraisals or management of planning could kind of prejudice the business conduct, like the restructure organization selection for redundancy, I think, to be honest, we could apply this. However, this will not be applicable if we're talking about like routine appraisals, because they are like normal procedures, I would say, company procedure, organization procedures, because we'll not be involved in the planning of the business.
Is it a business decision? Like if I agree that you know, Kate, you do such a good job, I want to move you into this position, but it means moving someone maybe out of it or moving someone else into somewhere. Is that management information that changes the business? I mean, I think so.
I think it could be, can be, but it's personal data as well. But it can be, yes, yeah. But in terms of comments, I would probably apply the third party, probably the third party exemption in terms of comments.
I was just going to say, I think it very much depends what's kind of discussed in that appraisal, because you're right, if a third party is discussed in that appraisal, that should probably be redacted because it is third party information. Mm-hmm. But the remainder of the appraisal, because it is about the data subject, I think should be disclosed.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I agree with you about the third party stuff. And if there was comments about a third party, I mean, in a small business, it's so easy to identify people from just the way things are said or what's said. Anything that makes somebody identifiable, you've got to bring into question, you know, is this something that's reasonable in these circumstances to disclose? And in some cases, it's the answer is going to be no, it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think even with stuff like emails, I think I'd be able to tell, regardless of what data's in there, from most people in DPP who sent an email based on how they like sign it off. Or little phrases that they'll use. You know, everybody else has their own kind of stuff, and it is. That is what makes it so difficult, isn't it? And people can tie themselves in knots going like, oh, but they may know it's so-and-so because of X, Y, and Z. And that is one of the hard things, is the impartiality, isn't it?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's so context sensitive that, you know, you've got somebody reviewing an email. They might take out all the names and leave in the cheers, you know,
Yeah.
And then you think, oh, that's from Phil, that is, because he always signs his
name. He's always said cheers. Yeah. But that would be probably it's a third party exemption as well, because you would be still identifiable from it, even if there is no direct link.
Somebody might not know that.
At the end of the day, everyone will be identifiable for everything.
Because you might, because I've had a similar issue with a customer I've been working on, because you may be looking at it as the person who's acting and thinking, oh, I know that's Kit, because I know she signs up all of her emails like this, or I know that she always like writes her emails in a certain way. But what you got to think about it personally, if the request is looking at it, are they going to look and go, oh, that's definitely Kate? Or are you just like maybe reaching and trying to connect too many dots? It's a very easy thing to do with SaaS, isn't it?
Yeah, who has to be the person that can
identify the person?
You know,
well, that's a good
point. You shared that with me, you said, look, I got this in my SAR pack, you know, there's nothing to stop you sharing it, man. Oh, that's from Kate, that is, she always does. I think it's really tricky, and this is what I love about, or don't love about, the definition of personalization, all the guidance around it, you know, the Phil Brining at is it easy, obvious stuff, everyone get, it's the other stuff, the words that in context identify somebody or relate to somebody, are the bits of personal data that I just love working with, and
yeah,
you know, that's the hard thing about the definition, isn't it?
I think the personal data is actually is defining there, but it's so broad and so tricky. We came across in the session, we're talking about the disrespect claims in the housing and disrespect claims, and talking about reports about living conditions, housing conditions, and one of the three participants just came with a question or was, so we have the report. If we read out, for example, the tenant's name and the address and any directly identifiables, but then we have within the report, we say, for example, that the house is not in clear conditions because the tenant did this or that, or actually there are mold, so is asthma. Would you that consider a special category data? And special category data, would it not? Will be redacted, will be withheld? It was something that we discussed a little bit about these reports, because there are, I've seen both. I've seen these reports being released because we're not considered personal data at all, as being withheld because it's not considered personal data. Or I've seen those being disclosed, redacted because we're considered.
Yeah.
I think it was very good. Yeah.
I have to say, I like Carl Rose. Carl Rose makes some excellent points. He's saying in here that he's declined to share recordings because on the balance of risk. And I think that is a vitally important point. We've got DPOs who are desperately trying to do what they think the law requires them to do. And once data is out there, it's out there. You cannot take it back. Yeah. So the most prudent thing to do, presumably, is to release. If you've got any question about this could be dangerous or damaging, don't release it, because the recourse is they go and complain to the ICO. ICO has a look at it and says either do or don't. And in my experience, same as in Carl's, the ICO usually sides with a data controller, especially if the data controller looks like they've got really tip-top processes. So if you've got a good process that looks robust, you've got a strongish position to start with.
Mm-hmm. This is quite an extreme example of what can happen if you do kind of over disclose. Is I have previously worked with on a case where once the information was provided, the ex-employee actually was so unhappy with what was provided, there were threats made, and there had to be police involvement because they were so concerned. So you do have to. Especially if you're a small organisation, you do have to protect. You've got a duty to protect your current staff as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's that duty of care that you have for your current employees, and potentially, not over disclosing certain information that may potentially lead to concerns like that for perhaps a volatile ex-employee.
Yeah, it's we're not kind of saying be cavalier with because this is a cornerstone of the law. But what we're saying is you really have to have a sensible, pragmatic, holistic approach to the information you're working with when you're dealing with SARS. Again, in my opinion, I might be wrong, but that's what I think.
I do agree with you. I mean, because you can always release, but as soon as it's released, you can all, you can never come back from that.
Yeah.
So if you can always, rebuild it,
it's always hard to disagree with Phil, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm gonna say something here which might again cause me issues, but I'm not having a pop at the legal profession here. But again, if you go to a lawyer and you ask about the same questions that we're discussing here, in my experience, they've got a professional code they have to comply with, so they would be much more cautious. Oh no, you got to do that. We're slightly more pragmatic, got more experience of working with this in practice, and we would say, well, you know, try this. We would try this, but it might not have legs. It might not stand up to scrutiny. But you know, think about the next steps and the consequences, and you know, give it well. But again, in my experience, I don't know if anybody will challenge that, but in my experience, the legal profession would be much more cautious and say, oh no, that's all disclosable, get it out there. And you know, I think that people, you know, like ourselves, practitioners, have got a better approach.
No, I agree.
Solicitors do kind of say, oh well, you'll receive it in disclosure anyway. That's what they try all the methods.
They go everywhere.
We're
the case that literally were four solicitors just from the same tenant, just send sales and disrespect claims for solicitors different ways, just appealing sales and disrespect claims from all the different things.
Yeah, and I do think there's DPOs do have that more sort of like care and consideration for the wider risk of personal data, not just we need to do what satisfies like the business's needs in being compliant, or you know, following the letter of the law. Whereas I think DPOs are a bit more honed in on the risk in general, of not even necessarily just upholding the SAR, but what it means if you did do that, or if you did disclose that much data, instead of we just need to do it because the law says so.
Yeah. Now, what do you think of this? I've got a tank change attack again. So Natalie earlier on in the conversation, 1302, asked whether are people allowed to ask what searches we will perform? You know, get transparency is a key. It said, are we obliged to? I mean, they can ask what they want.
I guess they're allowed to ask whatever.
Tell them.
I think it's up to you as to whether you want to tell them or not.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I would go into chapter and verse about I'm going to search this set of databases using this tool, because I'm not sure. I'm just not sure I would, actually. I don't think there's any obligation to.
Go for it, Kane.
I was going to say, but what if, as part of their request, they are very particular on what the search parameters are in terms of I want you to look at X system, Y system,
this email.
And then that's just you in an attempt. I don't think necessarily it should be a listing tool per se, but like I think if someone's like, I want all my data, and then you've gone, oh, we've looked in X system, this and that, and this is how we've done it, maybe that could present some form of risk, or maybe a hole in yourself, and they're like, oh, but have you checked here? Because I also want stuff from here. But I do think transparency in SaaS goes a long way.
I think transparency is, it's a really good question, because transparency is something we aspire to. We want to try and be open with people, really. But what we don't want to do is cause ourselves or the data subjects, you know, a load of hassle, get into an unwinnable argument about, well, I think you want to be using better tools to do your searches rather than Microsoft tools, or you know,
that could definitely happen. To be honest, that's a good point.
Yeah, I just wonder a question, because just about talking about the transparency and the exemption that we talked about management information, so. When we are releasing and disclosing the information and we apply the exemption of managing information, would you, in the knowledge letter, the letter that will accompany the disclosure, do say, well, we kept this data, withheld this data, with the managing information exemption be applicable because we are restructuring our business and releasing this information to you will actually prejudice the conduct?
But doesn't saying that's the exemption prejudice the application of the exemption?
No, I'm saying, like, for example, releasing type of information, reports, your appraisal reports, for example, instance, or any grievance, etc. Would you actually go further and explain why the exemption was applied in those specific cases?
Well, I think it depends, because if you like, I'm not provided it because we're looking to make some people redundant. you're basically telling them, you've told them exactly why, even if you're brief about it or vague about it, you've kind of told them why or what they're probably likely to find anyway. So you're kind of already like implying like this is what you're going to say, but we've just, you know, we said that we're not going to give you exemptions. You know what I mean?
I do agree, because I was just asking this because we have a recent SAR that actually the exemption was applied, and they asked our help to review the letter that would combine with the disclosure of the information or the without the information, and they were actually explaining document by document, or kind of system by system, why they were holding the data. So they were explaining that there was a restructure of the visas, no, they could not rely on the data. They were explaining that there was a grievance, this and that, so it would help the data. So I thought, okay, but if you are applying the exemption, you are already mentioning that these are happening, so you don't need to be that transparent. You do not need to be that specific.
No, I do think I agree with that pretty wholeheartedly. I mean, it's a shame that the chat has been so busy, because I do wish that we could get to all of the questions. There are so many. Of course, from one side, that if you are struggling with anything on the SAR side, that not to give you the seller or anything.
One of the things that Lindsay raised about SAR for somebody who's subject to an HR investigation, and it could be that the management forecasting and planning exemption might apply in some circumstances. But a couple of years ago, I was asked to comment on the use of an exemption. Because in the Law Enforcement Directive part, the Data Protection Act, there is an exemption for ongoing investigations. And this is a local authority. And they said, oh, we can use it as an exemption. I said, but you can't use that exemption, because whilst it's in the Data Protection Act, it's in the Law Enforcement Chapter 3 or Chapter 4, or whatever it is, Chapter 5, Chapter 4, is it, of the DPA. So it doesn't apply to you because you're not law enforcement. Again, you've got to know your way around the DPA, haven't you, to figure out what's applicable.
There's definitely caveats. It's a difficult piece of legislation to read half of the time, to be honest. It's not the
all
easiest.
All the time, not half the time.
Well, all the time. Fair enough. Yeah.
Right, now I can't believe, I mean, it's past already. I cannot believe that we've run out of time.
This was very fast.
Any last thoughts or observations or comments, or any first ones? Because you haven't said much, I haven't let you say much.
just reiterate what I said last time as well. I think don't panic when you get one. And if you've already got a great data mapping at your organization and a really good roper, you know where you're looking for that information from. So and also, you know, reach out to the data protection people as well, because they've been brilliant with every subject access request that I've come to them with. And it's also really nice to get that a third party to look at something and take the emotion away from the request from an employee or an ex-employee.
And talk to each other. I go on bang on about it. My commercial colleagues hate me for it, but we've got a good community here. You know, if you've all got the same kind of issues and problems, you can figure out the answers yourselves. Work with each other. Kate, anything to add?
No,
I've thoroughly enjoyed doing the podcast, and I think we should consider maybe doing them more frequently than.
I think we all agree. I just want to obviously extend my thanks to Nia for coming on. It's been 100%. Really great having you. It's been invaluable having your opinions as well. Although me, Kate and Phil are chatterboxes and we clamber all over each other. And I've really, really, really enjoyed doing these sessions recently, especially on the SARS one. It's been nice to have everybody so collaborative in the chat.
Yeah, I think to be honest, having a regular face-to-face sessions, I think would be, it's 100% something to think about, and definitely to have a more regular podcast, 100% to be back, probably we'll see. And thank you so much, Nia, for being here with us. I hope you have enjoyed it, and I hope you come back as well.
Well, the next session, I suspect we'll send out a note. I think Miles is jetting off somewhere nice and hot and sunny. I think the next session we're going to do will be on the DOA Act, won't it? It'll be unpicking what the data protection, whatever the data use and access bill is going to probably mean in practice. So we'll probably do that within the next 2 weeks. I reckon probably not next Friday, the Friday after. So if you're interested in in getting involved in the chat on the Doer, act as it will be when it finally gets into effect, then
good.
Join us next time. Yes.
Yeah. No, thank you so much, guys.
Thank you very much.
Have a great weekend. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.